Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Hi, welcome everybody to our ongoing series, A World at War. No, seriously, we're delighted to have back with us today Steve Biddle, one of the country's sanest and most knowledgeable defense analysts, to tell us about what's going on in Afghanistan. Steve was just over there and is now back here. He says it's even hotter there than here, and hopefully he was not referring just to the weather. So, Steve, you are going to tell us first what you saw, and then we'll get into a discussion of what it means.
Well, with respect to observations, let me start with what I think is the biggest big question about the war at the moment, which is whether we can win and whether we're winning. That's behind a lot of the trends in public opinion, ought to be driving strategy. And my sense of the debate here in the States has been that there's been a strongly pessimistic zeitgeist over the last couple of months, which I think is substantially overstated. I think we've been on a roller coaster ride where the command in theater, for a variety of reasons back in the spring, got substantially over-optimistic and led people to expect, I think, unrealistically rapid progress. They then ran into reality, and the result is now everyone's under-optimistic and excessively pessimistic. And I think what would be appropriate is if we all get back on the happy road in between. And let me flesh that out a little bit by saying a little bit on the security side of things and a little bit of, on the governance side of things, because I think this roller coaster ride is a response to stimuli on both of those scores. On the security side of things, We tend to want things like counterinsurgency to be like painting a house. Right? I mean, you start at the lower left-hand corner, you make steady, continuous progress, eventually the whole house is painted and you've got success. And the problem is it's a poor mental model for what's going on. I mean, COIN is a lot closer to surgery. You know, it's a long, painful process where indicators of trauma go up before they go down, and where the fact that trauma indicators are going up just don't tell you very much. Maybe they'll eventually go back down. You know, the patient is cured and you win, but patients die on the operating table too. I mean, the fact that trauma indicators are going up doesn't mean they're going to come back down. What it really tells you is that the violence statistics aren't worth much. And in many ways, where we are in Afghanistan right now is a lot like where we were in Iraq in June of 07, when the surge brigades had all arrived, violence was way up, and not a lot of good had been done from it yet that you could see in the casualty statistics. And at the time, back in June 07, that was widely interpreted as evidence of failure, which, of course, then it wasn't. But it wasn't a sign of success either. The trouble is you're in one of those moments where it's dark before the dawn and you don't know whether the dawn is coming or not.
Now, so when and how will you know whether dawn has arrived?
Well, I think it takes at least a good year, especially in Afghanistan, to know whether a given village or a given district has been stabilized and whether the model is working there or not. Especially in Afghanistan, the fighting is very seasonal. So until you've had a whole fighting season and a winter, it's very hard to know. Now, what that means is that there are places in Afghanistan where you can know something. And we spent some time in central Helmand on this last trip. And there are parts of central Helmand where we've been at this for a year or more, like, for example, Nadali, Nawa, and Garmsir, where the Taliban has been kicked out. They've tried to counterattack and reestablish themselves. That counterattack and reestablishment effort has largely failed, and the places are reasonably stable at this point. The war ain't over there by any stretch of the imagination, but they're reasonably stable. To an important degree, because we've been there for 18 months or more.
So what I hear you saying is that you have a Potter Stewart version of a definition of success, but not a Potter Stewart definition of failure. In other words, at some point, if it's working, you'll see the levels of violence come down, you'll see things start to stabilize, and then you'll know things are going well. But if that hasn't happened yet, it's hard to distinguish between it may happen down the road and it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and eventually there's kind of a statute of limitations on this. I mean, you can't reasonably expect after 5 or 6 years to keep saying, well, it'll happen eventually.
Well,
again, I think about a year to 18 months is a reasonable time frame. You have to live through a whole fighting cycle.
So in effect, you're saying we should have some kind of clock mentally ticking, not a hard clock, but a mental clock ticking. But we should have set it, in effect, for when the new sets of policies, the Afghan surge, essentially started to begin.
I think that's right. I also think we have to look at the details of the sequence of things that are going on rather than just the aggregate casualty statistics, especially at the national level. If the model is working, if COIN is doing what it's supposed to do, a series of things are supposed to happen more or less in order. First, you clear the bad guys out. Then the bad guys are going to try and counterattack. You have to expect that and resist it. The counterattacks have to gradually tail off, and then you have to build governance. So there's a series of things that happen. What I'm advocating in assessing the situation in Afghanistan is that we do it in a much more disaggregate way. We don't look at whether July is the highest casualty month in the history of the war relative to June at the national level. That doesn't tell us much. A, you got to look at particular places in terms of their own natural history. When did the operation start there? At what part of the process should you reasonably expect a place like Nawa as opposed to a place like Marja to be? And is what you're seeing consistent with what you would expect for this moment in the natural history of that place to be? Marja, I think you would reasonably expect that we're right smack in the middle of the first major fighting season since the United States showed up. And this is counterattack time. And I think that's basically what we're seeing. If we're still seeing the same thing next July in Marja, that's a really bad sign.
Okay. You're taking a very sensible, calm approach to this. There's an American political debate that is going on its own course and timetable. And, of course, the administration has locked itself in, at least rhetorically, to an 11 timetable for something. How does the sensible course you're suggesting interact with the also sensible for domestic political reasons course the administration is trying to adopt?
Well, I think to a large extent that depends on events on the ground and on the way the administration and the command presents them. So, for example, I think public support for the war is powerfully shaped by whether people think we're winning or losing. And this comes back to this question of how do you assess how things are going? So if you assess them right, locally and in time context, then I think the command and the administration need to start establishing the case that we're going about this in a step-by-step way, judge us on the places where we've had enough time, and assess accordingly. Now, I think that's, in fact, what they're doing. The December 2010 reassessment window that was so much discussed at the time of the president's West Point speech is, as far as I can tell, being down-pedaled, which I think is largely a statement that for the places where the command, I think erroneously or I think ill-advisedly, put so much emphasis, the new offensive actions in Marja and Kandahar, they're just not going to know by December because it's not going to be, again, you won't have seen a full fighting season after we clear the place by that time. So I think they're trying to say essentially that they won't know enough by then to be able to get a good gauge on how the war is always going, and they're trying to suggest we're going to make this decision later. I think if the offenses that we conduct in Marja and Kandahar, for instance, bear the fruit that one would hope and expect them to bear, then I think the public will allow sort of a continued extending of the clock. If they don't, if by July 2011 Kandahar is a disaster area and Marja has not turned, I think it's going to be very hard to sustain public support.
Let me take you into two areas that have been much in discussion in the media, at least, over the last few months. The first is the change in command, and the second is the WikiLeaks. What I hear you saying, or my impression, is that the change in command actually didn't have all that dramatic an effect on the war, and that, in effect, it's not really what seemed like a dramatic episode, which was dramatic in terms of persons, people, and media play and so forth, was not actually dramatic in terms of conduct of the war. Is that the case?
I think that's right. I mean, after all, McChrystal's strategy had been conducted under Petraeus's guidance. I mean, Petraeus was McChrystal's boss. So the idea that Petraeus would have some radically different idea of how to conduct the war is inconsistent with the idea that, that he was in a position to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down on the way the war had been being conducted. Now, I'm sure you'll see some things get more emphasis at the margin, other things get less emphasis at the margin, but I'd be shocked if there were some major redirection, some transformative moment in the way the war is being waged.
And what's your take on the WikiLeaks controversy? Nothing to see here, move along, or anything dramatic or interesting in that?
Well, I mean, it's damaging in a variety of ways. In part, when you look at the dynamics of counterinsurgency tactically on the ground, you're trying to convince people that they will survive the act of cooperating with you. That's what the troop presence does at the end of the day. And obviously having the names of people who cooperate with us broadcast to internet-savvy folks like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban is not helping us in that score. Now, by the same token, the proof will be in the pudding as to whether or not we, whether or not we can, in fact, protect these folks after their names have been revealed. That's unhelpful. I don't think it will be decisive in the larger scheme of the war, but it's certainly unhelpful. The politics of it, similarly, I think, are unhelpful for those who believe the war is worth waging, but I think are unlikely to be decisive in the same way that the Pentagon Papers, you know, arguably were back in Vietnam, largely because of the content of what these this thing was as opposed to what the Pentagon Papers were. The Pentagon Papers were an actual analysis. This is just a data dump.
Okay.
A, and it's a data dump that ended before the administration implemented their new strategy. So the fact that it shows declining fortunes in some extremely sprawling disaggregate sense isn't inconsistent with the administration's own narrative of the war, which is that things were getting worse, then administrations changed, strategy was redirected, and now you should expect that things are on a better path. There's nothing.
Of course, that was true of the Pentagon Papers as well, Steve.
Well,
that was true with the Pentagon Papers as well. It was the Johnson administration's papers that came out during Nixon.
Yeah, but by the Nixon administration, the strategic context of the war was out, not in and up.
Right. You've been very dispassionate and calm about discussing this. Let me take you out of that for a second. You have a parent of a soldier going off to Afghanistan. The parent reads that there are only a few score Al-Qaeda operatives left. Many of those probably are in Pakistan. Why in the world is their child being sent off in the endless year of an endless war to die in some dusty place in the middle of nowhere? What is the actual, what is the sort of high concept, serious rationale for why this continuing expenditure of blood and treasure is worth it for the United States?
Well, the administration has made two arguments for why it's worth it, that Afghanistan should not be allowed to become, again, a base for striking the United States, and that Afghanistan not be allowed to become a base for destabilizing its neighbors, especially Pakistan.
Now, do you buy both, either of those?
Well, they're both reasonable, but the first is not particularly compelling. The second is, I think, much the stronger of the two. There's nothing literally unique about Afghanistan as a potential base for attacking the United States. There are lots of ill-governed spaces around the world that could be used for Al-Qaeda Global to set up a new base. They could use Yemen, they could use Somalia, they could use Djibouti. There's plenty of alternatives to Afghanistan. We're not going to deploy 100,000 American ground troops everywhere Al-Qaeda might possibly send up a base. We obviously can't do that. But Afghanistan is literally unique as a base for destabilizing Pakistan. And Pakistan is a unique national security threat to the United States. It's a nuclear weapons state with Al-Qaeda's global headquarters in their borders and an ongoing internal war that, by lots of indicators, isn't going very well for the Pakistani government. If the counterinsurgency project in Afghanistan were to fail, and the Karzai government were to be replaced with either chaos and renewed civil warfare, or I think less likely but still possible, some sort of neo-Taliban restoration, that would be a substantial source of instability and aggravation and reduction in the prospects of the ongoing war in Pakistan, which is central and vital to U.S. national security interests. A government collapse and state failure in Pakistan is one of the very few ways that I think are at all plausible in which Osama bin Laden could get his hands on a usable nuclear weapon. And there aren't a lot of ways for us to affect that prognosis directly. In many ways, our strongest influence over what happens in Pakistan is our ability to prevent Afghanistan from becoming an open sore that makes the Pakistani situation a lot worse.
That actually scares me more than if you had given the reverse answer, because however sort of relatively minor the Afghan danger would seem to be, the idea of fighting a nasty, ongoing, unsatisfying war simply for a domino theory aspect of what might happen in a neighboring state if the war doesn't go well strikes me as so tenuous a connection that it really is going to be hard to justify. And I think over time you might get into a political dynamic in which if the war doesn't get the prospects don't seem to get any better, that the public might not find that convincing. Do you worry about that?
Well, I mean, people use domino theory as a pejorative wording when they oppose a war. The idea that states worry about the stability of their neighbors because they worry about the stability of their own country is ubiquitous in international politics. One of the central reasons why the United States got involved in the Balkans back in the 1990s was the fear that chaos in the Balkans could spread to our NATO neighbors and trading partners. The Soviet Union was continuously worried about instability on its borders. This is a normal concern in international affairs. It's not like a imaginary ghost dreamed up by people who want to do Vietnam War revisionism.
Understood entirely.
I don't think that this is an absolute transcendent be-all and end-all threat to U.S. national security that we should be willing to pay any price and bear any burden in order to deal with. I've argued in the past, and I continue to believe, that Afghanistan is a close call on the merits because the stakes, while important, are indirect and are not unlimited. And obviously the cost of waging this war is clearly high. So what it boils down to, I think, is neither a slam dunk in favor of waging the war, in which any reasonable person must surely think this is worth it, nor a slam dunk in which this war is obviously crazy and any reasonable person should think that we should get out tomorrow morning. I think what you end up with is a situation where the costs and the benefits are pretty close on the analytics, and it boils down to a value judgment that reasonable people will make differently about how much cost should you be willing to bear to reduce how much of a threat. Now, the threat here, if the worst-case scenario unfolds, is pretty serious. I mean, you may or may not have worried about nuclear weapons in Soviet hands during the Cold War. Bin Laden would probably use the things if he got them. And an American decision by a presidential administration that could reasonably have waged this war with some respectable prospect of success but decided instead to withdraw, if that scenario played itself out, and Pakistan collapsed, bin Laden got a nuclear weapon and used it in the United States, that would be regarded by generations of historians as the single biggest foreign policy blunder in the history of the nation. Now, a variety of bad things have to happen in sequence for that worst case to play itself out. That's why I think this is a close call rather than an obvious do it or an obvious don't. But I think especially with respect to the guy in the Oval Office who has to bear the responsibility for this, that I suspect that worst case looms fairly large. But I think all indications are that the president is pretty ambivalent about this, in part because I suspect he sees the costs and benefits as being closer on the margin than one would in some ways like.
Very interesting analysis. At this point, we have a lot of people chomping at the bit to get in and ask you their questions, so I will stop hogging you and throw it open to Q&A. So please identify yourselves and listen to the instructions on how to ask questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the queue, press star 2. Again, for questions, that's star 1. Our first question comes from Chanreka Pancholi with Overseas India Weekly.
Hi. Can you, about winning the war in Afghanistan, why don't you think that we have to have a war inside Pakistan to take out whatever terrorist camps they have, whatever pockets of terrorism creation are there, because they will keep bleeding us to death in Afghanistan, because Pakistani intelligence agency is creating a terror network to be sent to India, sent to Britain, sent to United States. So, and why we think that Pakistan is a sovereign country, so we cannot interfere when Afghanistan was a sovereign country, Iraq was a sovereign country, it never stopped us from going and hitting terror networks. So do you think that the war should be inside Pakistan to save Afghanistan?
Well, there is a war inside Pakistan. By any normal academic definition of war, there is currently a fairly intense war and fairly intense insurgency going on inside Pakistan. Again, my primary concern with U.S. interests in Afghanistan is precisely the prognosis and future conduct of the war in Pakistan. Now, I think the burden of your question is less, should there be a war in Pakistan? I mean, clearly there is one. And more, should the United States be more forceful, either in unilaterally conducting it? We do some, it is reported, military activity by way of airstrikes and training in Pakistan, should we substantially escalate that? The problem here is that the Pakistani government and public's tolerance for a substantially more forceful U.S. conduct of counterinsurgency or counterterrorism operations in Pakistan is obviously very limited. You could end up, if you did this too forcefully, causing the very thing you're trying to prevent. We could easily end up in the collapse of the government there. That would be a catastrophe. If the United States is this strapped, trying to wage an effective counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, a country with a much smaller population, a probably smaller insurgent population, and a much smaller economy, I think trying to wage a full-scale counterinsurgency in Pakistan would be radically harder. So I think the notion that the United States could solve the underlying problem by going to war in Pakistan as opposed to going to war in Afghanistan is unrealistic. Now, some, reportedly including the vice president, have argued that what we really ought to do is simply to rely more heavily than we do now on the kinds of drone strikes against al-Qaeda per se that we are now doing in Pakistan, and throttle back dramatically on counterinsurgency activities in Afghanistan. The problem here is that what that amounts to is taking one piece of ordinary counterinsurgency theory out of the context of the rest of it and not doing the rest of it. I mean, counterinsurgency, ordinarily conceived, is a mix of population security, governance reform, economic development, and leadership targeting. There is a lot of leadership targeting going on within Afghanistan directed at the Afghan Taliban, as well as within Pakistan going after al-Qaeda. Within the context of the whole, the pieces mutually support one another, and if it's done right, the whole is more effective than the sum of the parts. If you pull one out and don't do any of the rest, especially if you pull one out in a way that undermines the rest, as I think a substantially accelerated counterterror drone campaign in Pakistan could easily do. It could undermine the efficacy of the Pakistani government's own counterinsurgency campaign if it's not handled well. The result could be to make things a lot worse rather than better. I mean, if the Pakistani government's own counterinsurgency campaign fails and that government collapses, the problem is going to expand radically beyond the ability of any program of drone strikes to deal with. I don't think drone strikes in the midst of a country that could end up in chaos is a sufficient solution to this problem. It looks more like a Band-Aid than like a real answer.
Can we use our influence on the military to find out these ISI agents who are helping create terror and get them dismissed or arrested?
Well, you know, U.S. government is working very hard to try and influence the Pakistani military, the Pakistani government, and the Pakistani intelligence services to be less tolerant of a variety of terrorist groups within their borders that they have historically been pretty supportive of. Now, the problem here is that so far we've been telling the Pakistanis to do something that the Pakistanis themselves don't believe is in their self-interest. I mean, many of the terrorist groups within Pakistan that we worry about now were either set up or are the progeny of organizations that were set up by the Pakistanis as asymmetric warfare devices against India prior to 2001, which then turned against the Pakistani government in part because the Pakistani government aligned with the hated United States after 2001, when the Bush administration went to Pervez Musharraf and basically said, either you side with us against the Taliban or we're going to get rid of you. Effectively, Musharraf backed down, sided with the United States, and substantially alienated lots of Islamist organization, Islamist militant organizations within his own borders, which then turned on the Pakistani civilian government. But the Pakistanis have tended to believe ever since then that these are people that they can work with, and that they don't want to completely annihilate them because they still think they're going to be potentially useful in dealing with the Indian threat that they believe they still face down the road. What the United States has been trying to do is to persuade the Pakistani government that these are now Frankenstein's monsters that threaten you a lot more than India does. You ought to clean them out. The Pakistanis prefer to hedge their bets. So what we've got is an intermediate outcome where Pakistan isn't as supportive of them as they once were, but neither do they completely wipe them out.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Trudy Rubin with the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Hi, Steve.
Hi,
a couple of things I'm curious about from your trip. The whole basis of COIN in Afghanistan was based on the idea of shifting the momentum, as you know better than I, and Kandahar was supposed to shift that momentum. In other words, it was heavily psychological, sort of like Mazar Sharif shifted the momentum in the Afghan war in 2001, and then other places came along, people withdrew their support from the Taliban, et cetera. Do you see any sign that there is going to be some critical mass, whether one large place or a group of places, that are going to turn around and shift the momentum? Because otherwise, if you just have a little progress in one place, a little progress in another place, doesn't really matter. And connected with that, as you also know full well, everyone in Afghanistan and Pakistan thinks we're leaving by 2011. Doesn't matter if Obama and some of his team are hedging their vocabulary in the United States, and they're acting accordingly. So how can you shift the momentum if there's an assumption that we're already on the way out?
I mean, I tend not to be a big fan of kind of tipping point models of radical change in momentum. Sometimes it happens. The Sons of Iraq in Iraq produced something like that. But I don't think you can rely on that in counterinsurgency. I think what eventually, turns the course of the war and causes violence statistics, for example, to come down, is the provision of enough security in enough of the populated area of the country that gradually the insurgents have a harder and harder time operating and causing casualties. I was not particularly comfortable with the analysis of Kandahar that held that this is a decisive moment in the course of the war, and that if we secure Kandahar, the Taliban will suddenly reevaluate. I mean, I tend to think that the Taliban are fairly rational strategic analysts, and they look at their prognosis in the country as a whole, and that in many ways what's been going on in Helmand is as important as anything else in terms of demonstrating whether or not the coalition has the ability to push them out of an area and keep them out. I doubt that one way or another, Kandahar is going to create a situation in which the war is either won or is lost in a period of a couple of months. as a function of some operation in Kandahar City. I especially in light of the July 2011 date, which brings me to the other part of your question. I have been struck before, but I was especially struck on this trip by just how fixated people in the region are on July 2011. I mean, there was a couple of conversations with Afghan parliamentarians, for example, where one would try to make the argument that if you guys are just going to look at the entire array of evidence on the degree to which the United States is committed to an outcome in this war, you would have to consider that we are more than tripling our troop strength in your country, that we have just appointed the single most celebrated military officer in the Western world to run this campaign, and that the president has repeatedly, when given a choice, doubled down on this war rather than backing out. And in the face of all that evidence, here's this one line in one speech about July 2011 that every administration official asked by the Congress within 2 weeks of the speech then backed away from, and they ignore all that and just fasten in on the July 2011 thing. It's clear that rightly or wrongly, it's had a huge effect on perceptions in the region. I think the only thing that's going to change those perceptions is if, in fact, we don't disappear in August 2011. I mean, the perception of many in Afghanistan is that we're going away by August 2011. Nobody in the administration, not even the most ardent opponent of the war, is saying we're going to go away, and yet that's the perception in large parts of Afghanistan, certainly, if not also Pakistan. I think as it becomes clear that we are not, in fact, decamping and going home as of August 2011, that will change perceptions. I think in classic counterinsurgency theory, it's actions, not words, that do the job. You need to do the words as well as you can, but it's the civilian population's personal observation that there are security forces around that are protecting people who cooperate with them and are killing and capturing enough enemy that it's safe to cooperate. It's direct observation of what the counterinsurgent does that matters, and I think the only way this perception will change and the only way people's assessment of how committed the United States is will change is if, in fact, the United States doesn't just go away in July 2011. I happen to think we won't.
But just a follow-up, does that then mean, however, that in the coming months, tribal leaders, et cetera, will be sitting on the fence because they think we're leaving, which then affects popular perceptions because it means we won't make much progress by 2011, by that deadline, which then affects what we actually do.
Well, I don't think you're going to see tribal leaders, for example, en masse swinging to our side by July 2011 for that reason. Again, I don't think you're going to see a Sons of Iraq-like moment or phenomenon in Afghanistan for that and other reasons. By the same token, though, in places like, and let's go back to Helmand, where operations have been in conduct for a while now, neither are they going to substantially assist the Taliban in areas where the Taliban don't have control either. And what's going to happen as the Afghan security forces grow and as the reinforcements that are flowing into the theater get disposed around the country, is that the Taliban are going to find that in the areas of the country that they've put the most emphasis on, the south and the east, they're going to have less and less freedom of maneuver. So I don't think you're going to see a moment of transformation of some kind in which people come off the fence, suddenly the Taliban are kicked out of the country. But I think what you are going to see is a gradual restriction in the Taliban's freedom to control places that they used to control. And I suspect, where we've been there long enough, a reduction in violence associated with that reduction in their freedom to operate and freedom to move in places like Helmand and in places like Kandahar. And then when people see after July 2011 that we're not leaving, my guess is that the move off the fence and toward cooperation will build after that. But what you're likely to see before then is something that's closer to a lot of watching and waiting where people don't, but in which people don't side with the Taliban either. And that will in turn restrict their ability to visit violence in large quantities on civilians in those areas.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Yachi Drezin with the National Journal.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Can you talk a bit about how you square the circle when you have what your point before about the sort of political debate potentially outstripping and the pessimism that's part of it outstripping the reality on the ground? But I think a large part of that is the seeming disconnect between a strategy that is continually described as an anti-terror strategy and an on-the-ground reality that both under McChrystal and under Petraeus appears to be nation-building without the term nation-building attached to it. I mean, how do you square that when you have it being defended publicly by the administration as focused on Al-Qaeda, focused on preventing Afghanistan from becoming a base again for transnational attacks, with the kind of economic development, the political development, and the other coin elements that really look much more like nation-building than they do a strict counter-terror mission?
Well, one of the things that makes this politically very difficult for the administration is that their argument is, at the end of the day, substantially indirect. The counterterror, the strong counterterror case for waging counterinsurgency in Afghanistan is its effect on its neighbor. That's a tough argument to make. I mean, I can do it in settings like this because I get lots of time and patience from thoughtful journalists who are willing to sit and listen to me, you know, unfold the story. In a soundbite environment of a highly partisan domestic public square for an elected official, it's a hard argument to make because it's a complicated story to tell. And again, because at the end of the day, in my lights, you end up being fairly close on the analytic costs and benefits even once you've done that. I don't envy the administration the political communication task of taking a situation that's A, this complicated, and B, this close on the merits, and selling it. Among the many reasons why I'm glad I'm here at the council is that I don't have to have the challenge of selling in the public square a situation that's complicated, ambiguous, and a close call on the merits. But I think what they're trying to do is take the argument back to its roots. I mean, the reason we're in Afghanistan at the end of the day really is Al-Qaeda. The trouble is doing that leads them into a problem in which the analysis is an indirect argument running through Pakistan much more persuasively, in my view, than it is a direct argument that Afghanistan as a potential base for Osama bin Laden is worth 100,000 troops, whereas Yemen or Somalia is not.
And just to also to follow on a point you made earlier, you were talking about how in places like Marja, for instance, we had to go through a full fighting season, really, to get a sense of conditions there. You'd also mentioned that the previous command had been overly optimistic in its public comments about Marja and other parts of the campaign. Where do you think that overconfidence came from, and what is likely to prevent this command, given that the July 2011 deadline is looming even closer, from making those same types of pronouncements?
At the end of the day, it's hard for me to explain the motives of other people like General McChrystal or his staff. I mean, I know it sounds a bit evasive, but the best answer, of course, is to ask them. All I can do is speculate as to why they were so optimistic. I was there in January when it was clear that they were getting pretty optimistic about the spring and summer, and I wasn't entirely sure why at the time. If I were to speculate, the initial results in Marja showed more progress than you would normally expect. I mean, people were starting to cooperate with the Marines within a couple of days of the Marines showing up. Normally, you expect it's going to take a while before they trust that you're going to be there and protect them before you start getting much in the way of tips or interaction. That started pretty early. Perhaps they extrapolated too much from something that was happening in the very, very early stages of what we all should have known was going to be a long campaign there. Perhaps they were optimistic because of leadership targeting efforts. I don't know. This is very speculative on my part. All I can say from knowledge is when I was there in July of 2009 on the assessment team, my expectation was that this is going to be a long, hard slog, and that you wouldn't expect to see a substantial change in the amount of populated area under government control until the reinforcements arrived and the ink spots of counterinsurgency success started spreading and you managed to apply traditional counterinsurgency in more places, none of which you would reasonably have expected to occur until the reinforcements were all in place, which they certainly were not last spring. So I was a bit puzzled by the degree of optimism we saw. I don't think this command group will be comparably optimistic. I mean, a standard element of the David Petraeus playbook is under-promise and over-deliver. And certainly the way he talked about the Iraq War very rarely slid over into excessive promising and optimism about the way things were going to go. Instead, we got cliches like, you know, keep the champagne in the back of the refrigerator, formulations of that kind. I don't think we'll see more of these kind of roller coasters of overpromising followed by over despair followed by who knows what. I suspect we're going to be on a less exciting as a public relations trajectory.
Our next question comes from Emily Cady with Congressional Quarterly. Yes, Emily, you may begin. Sorry, our next question comes from James Kitfield.
Hi, Stephen. You haven't talked about Karzai and his government. The most recent reports were that he's now pushing back against these anti-corruption task forces, raising the question once again of what kind of a partner he is. I'm just curious what sort of feedback you got while you were in the field about how cooperative his government was being, whether they were doing the things necessary to give people hope that they would fulfill their part of the bargain in counterinsurgency.
Well, I mean, of course, it's a mixed bag. His stated policy is strongly anti-corruption-oriented. Lots of his actual behaviors are much less so. I think there's a tendency in the U.S. debate, though, to want to set the relationship with Karzai up as either he's a good guy and an adequate partner, or he's hopeless and he's an inadequate partner. We just can't succeed unless this guy, you know, is changed or has some moment of transformation. And that's not normally the way counterinsurgencies go. I mean, you always have an inadequate partner in counterinsurgency. That's why there's an insurgency to counter. If the host government were good at this, we wouldn't have to be involved in the first place. So you inevitably at least start with a partner that by definition has serious legitimacy problems, often involving corruption. If you're going to succeed, that means changing the behavior of the host government and changing behaviors that the host government doesn't want to change. I mean, normally the legitimacy problem that gave rise to the insurgency in the first place was some sort of unrepresentative distribution of power or wealth or resources in the country benefiting one subgroup to the exclusion of others who then turned to insurgents for succor and hope. The people who are benefiting from this normally want to keep benefiting from this, and they resist and they push back when the outside counterinsurgent tries to get them to reform, because that reform means less benefits for their subgroup. So you normally get pushback, and that's exactly what we're seeing, and it's exactly what we should expect. And if we're going to succeed, the right metaphor for this, it seems to me, is a tug of war. We can expect Karzai to pull back on the other side of the rope all the time because he believes that his political self-interest requires him to rely on groups that are benefiting from corruption and abuse of power to keep himself in office. When we tell him to get rid of these people and clean all this up, he thinks it's a threat to his own tenure in office and he'll resist. We have to pull him in the other direction. And in principle, we have plenty of resources with which to do that. We do thousands of things in Afghanistan every day. The Karzai government's survival is utterly dependent on this. and we can turn them on or turn them off singly or in combination as necessary to generate leverage to gradually win the tug of war. But we're not going to win it all of a sudden one morning. I mean, every day we're going to roll out of bed and we're going to have to pull Karzai a little further in our direction and he's going to pull back again. And so there are going to be periodic episodes where he tries to shut down some anti-corruption agency that we think is doing a great job, and we have to pull him back in the direction of being more forceful in reforming his government than he otherwise wants to be. I think in principle we have the resources to do that effectively, given the enormous expenditure of resources we do in this country. But we have to be very careful with how we do it. We've tended to be on this kind of pendulum oscillation between extremes with Karzai. The Bush administration was much too cozy with the guy. They tended to be something close to a policy of all carrots and no sticks because they thought Karzai was a hero and an ally and shouldn't be coerced. The Obama administration came into office believing that that was a mistake and crashed down on him with lots and lots of sticks and not much in the way of carrots. And the sticks were delivered publicly in ways that were domestically humiliating to Karzai. That didn't work so well, and so the administration has changed course again. What I think we need is a tack toward the center and an avoidance of these extremes where we don't give up on sticks. We have to use leverage or we're not going to succeed in this. If we do not get reform of the host government, this campaign will fail, and that's not going to happen without the use of coercive sticks. But the sticks have to be private rather than public, and they have to be done in a sequence that makes sense. And for example, let's take the corruption problem. To get the corruption problem under control, let's say, rather than fix, because I don't want to imply that the right level of corruption in Afghanistan is zero, but to get the corruption problem under control, eventually it's going to require some big asks of Hamid Karzai. He's going to have to accept the removal or prosecution of some senior people in the country in all likelihood. That's not the best way to start the process. A lot of the money that flows into corrupt activity in Afghanistan comes from us. It comes from our own contracting, which goes to fuel malign actor networks in the country that at the end of the day are substantially hurting our prospects by making people in Afghanistan turn to the Taliban for protection. The right way to start the process is by reducing our own contribution to the problem by reforming the way we do contracting, for example, in a way that causes us to provide less fuel and ammunition to the malign actor networks that are undermining our counterinsurgency prospects to the degree that we are. As we do that, we in turn weaken the political power of malign actors within the country because we deny them funds. You can think of money as the hydraulic fluid that enables the political machines that are these malign actor networks in the country to do work. A lot of that money and hydraulic fluid is coming from us. If we shut off the flow into the system, we reduce the hydraulic pressure within the machine and we reduce its ability to do political work. And that in turn makes the eventual ask of Karzai easier. Doing things in the right sequence and doing things privately and not publicly are both important, it seems to me. And last but not least, doing things in ways that support Karzai's political future in the country rather than damaging it is helpful. Part of that's a matter of trying not to criticize him publicly by U.S. government officials wherever it can be avoided. Part of it is a matter of supporting his own better instincts wherever we can. Again, Karzai is on public record repeatedly as supporting anti-corruption efforts in Afghanistan. Now, obviously, in a variety of ways, the Afghan government's behavior has been inconsistent on this, but wherever possible, it seems to me, we ought to help Karzai carry out his own stated policies, which are substantially anti-corruption in nature.
Can I just follow up After the McChrystal fire and the Rolling Stone interview created this perception that there was a divide between Eikenberry and McChrystal on Karzai and whether how reliable he was. Did you get any sense whether the relationship between Petraeus and Karzai and Eikenberry that has been squared, where everyone at least is operating off something like a similar page?
I did not see the men together.
Okay. Thanks.
Steve, we're getting close to the end here of a fantastic session, and one of the times the old things we always do is on end on time. Let me just take one final question to get you on the record about not Afghanistan but Iraq. As we go forward in Afghanistan, you might say almost the best-case scenario is that we have a good, strong late innings, which gives us the chance to extricate ourselves without too much disaster behind, supposedly as in Iraq. So what do you see happening in Iraq, and do you think we will be able to continue to draw down American forces and essentially get out of there without disaster following?
Well, I think if we withdraw U.S. forces on the schedule that the Status of Forces Agreement requires, I think there's a substantial danger that you could end up with things turning around in Iraq and violence returning. The Status of Forces Agreement calls for a really remarkable drawdown in U.S. military presence. No American forces, period, of any kind, performing any function after the end of 2011. Now, if you view Iraq in the right context, which it seems to me is the context of intense ethno-sectarian civil wars of identity, which is what Iraq was by 2006 to 2007, and what the Balkans were, rarely do intense ethno-sectarian civil wars of identity simply resolve themselves overnight, where people forget about the past, get over their fears of genocidal attack by rivals, and suddenly just live together under a benign political process. I think fears of this kind subside, but they subside slowly over time with experience of non-genocide. And often when intense ethno-sectarian civil wars of identity resolve themselves through negotiated agreement and stay peaceful, it's because there are outside peacekeepers there that reduce the degree to which the former rivals feel threatened by one another while they gradually get used to coexisting. In the Balkans, large initial peacekeeping forces were eventually substantially drawn down. There are about 5% as many peacekeepers in Bosnia today, for example, as there were in the initial aftermath of the settlement there. But the drawdown was progressive, incremental, and slow, without any transformative moment at which suddenly everything was going to change because all the peacekeepers were going to go home. And the result was it enabled the peacekeeping force strength to decline roughly in parallel with the declining mutual fears of the formerly warring groups. I'm worried that the drawdown in Iraq, if it proceeds according to the tempo in the Status of Force Agreement, will be much faster than that and will have a declared, well-known, publicized endpoint to it that constitutes a focal point for still wary former combatants to focus their attentions and fears on. I would prefer to see a substantial drawdown, but a gradual, progressive, incremental drawdown rather than one that has this sudden endpoint. And in that sense, I worry a lot more about the end of 2011 than I do about August of 2010. All the focus recently has been on the end of combat operations in Iraq. Well, there are still 50,000 U.S. troops in the country, and we call them advise and assist brigades, and their mission is no longer combat. But in fact, they have a very substantial combat potential. Now, I worry more about the total withdrawal coming quite soon, actually, and the effect that could have in a situation where I think it's unrealistic to expect that Iraqi Sunnis and Iraqi Shia are just going to suddenly get over long-standing fears of one another fueled by actual experience in a very, very bitter war.
And do you think that those concerns are shared in the U.S. administration, and so they might therefore be headed off?
Well, I think, let me speak to the related issue of what the Iraqi administration thinks about it. I think there has historically been substantial sympathy for a U.S. troop presence in the country for exactly this reason among Iraqi decision-making elites. Not all. Obviously, Muqtada al-Sadr and others don't share this view. But among a substantial range of mainstream Iraqi political figures, there has in the past been a lot of acceptance of the need for an ongoing U.S. military presence, albeit a smaller one. The trouble is domestic partisan political incentives within Iraq, driven by presidential and parliamentary elections there, have made it impossible for anybody to say this in public. And so Iraqis have ended up competing with each other to get to their anti-American flank because they know that the American presence is unpopular among voters on the street. My suspicion is that once the partisan dust settles and we get some months or year between an election campaign and a decision, or between a government formation process, as we're seeing now, and a decision, my guess is that the decision could very well be a lot more accepting of the idea of negotiating a follow-on to the Status of Forces Agreement that foresees some continued U.S. non-zero presence that ramps down more gradually and slowly rather than so suddenly in this kind of step function thing. But we shall see.
Thank you very much, Stephen Biddle. Thank all of you for listening in and asking questions, and we will convene in some future date when Steve can give us his version of what's happened next. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.